On Tech News Today, we've got reporters at Google I.O. to tell you about Google's big announcements. Plus, the Supreme Court rules against Aereo. What does it mean for the future of cloud services in your streaming TV? You're about to find out. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, June 26th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Apple and Android devices are worth at gazelle.com. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin. Jason is Google I.O. collecting his free smartwatch. And Brian Burnett is here with us filling in for Jason. We also have Elise Hugh, our Thursday co-anchor. Welcome to you, Elise.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here.
So today we're going to be talking about the World Cup of Technology, which of course is Google I.O. For that other World Cup, you can just move along. There's nothing to see there. Google I.O. was really kind of interesting yesterday during the keynote because Sundar Pichai was bragging a lot about the number of women at the conference. He said that there were 1,000 women in the room, which got a big round of applause, oddly, and that something like 20% of the developer attendees were female, up from 8% the year before that. It was a kind of an interesting thing, but you wrote a really interesting piece about Facebook's newly reported diversity numbers. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I called this kind of the summer of the demographic data dumps. These tech companies have had an assumed gender gap and diversity out of whack for years, but they've been resistant to actually sharing the data that shows the extent of these gaps. This summer, Google led the pack in releasing its data and apologized for taking so long for doing so. Then Yahoo followed suit, and then this week Facebook came out with its numbers. They very closely mirror Google's, which shows a staff of nearly 70% male, 30% female, and then dominated by those who identify themselves as white and Asian. And so all the tech companies are starting to sort of get hip to the fact that diversity matters, and then looking for solutions to this pipeline problem. So it's encouraging that they're finally starting to show this data.
Yeah, and it's discouraging to a certain extent, in my opinion, that it's so much of it is put on the tech companies. It's great that, you know, they have been remiss in their hiring and development plans and so on. But it's also, it takes a village to raise an engineer. And our whole educational system is failing to inspire women and minorities to get into engineering and some of the job types that companies like Google and Facebook have to hire. I think the solution, if we can't get our education system turned around and we can't produce more female engineers and minority engineers, then we need to open up the H-1B visa program to recruit from countries that do a better job than the United States does. One way or the other, it's great that there's finally some attention placed on all that. But it was a great piece, and everybody should go read it. That's at npr.org. That they can see that. And that was all tech considered, right?
That's right. That's my blog at NPR. NPR.org's tech blog is called All Tech Considered, but really it's Some Tech Considered, okay, because I focus specifically on tech and society and how it's changing the way we connect and behave with one another.
Yeah, nobody has time to consider all tech.
It's a play on the name of one of our shows, right?
That's right. Well, let's jump right into the news, of course. Google announced a wide range of new products and services at yesterday's Google I.O. Developers Conference keynote. Seth Weintraub is publisher and editorial director of the 9to5 Sites. Dom Chmielewski is a senior editor for Recode. And Peter Patchell is Mashable's tech editor. And I welcome all three of you who are all reporting in from essentially the press room at Google I.O. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
All right, so we're gonna be switching back and forth rapidly between all of you. But let's start with you, Seth Weintraub. Android Wear was clearly the star of the show. All the sessions that involved Android Wear were mobbed, and of course, the booth where they were demonstrating Android Wear watches were also mobbed. So, Seth Weintraub, let's talk about the Android Wear announcements. What new information did we learn yesterday?
We have lost Seth.
Okay, so we'll throw that to Don. Can you address that question, Don?
And we
lost Don as
Don
well.
Don and Seth, we have lost. The two people in the convention hall.
Okay,
but
so
we have Pete.
We have Pete, our glass hole in chief. Welcome so much. Thank you so much for having a connection. I appreciate that. I guess the bad place to be is inside the press room.
And here I thought I would have had the worst connection being a wireless. But anyway, Android Wear, you know, we learned basically who's going to make the first ones, although we kind of already knew that. But now we know how much it's going to cost. And I've actually got both of the first watches on right now. This one here is the Samsung Gear Live. That was the one surprise that had not been announced before. And this is the LG G Watch, and that's a little dormant right now because actually I found out that you can only have one Android Wear device paired with your phone at any one time. So I have the Gear Live right here. We also basically got a look at what Android Wear will look like, how it's going to work on your phone, and how it differs from other previous smartwatches. Most smartwatches before now have basically mirrored a very similar app paradigm that you get on a phone with tiny little icons and tapping. The Sony Smartwatch 2 works this way. The Gear 2, the Samsung Gear 2 works this way. And Android Wear seems, at least it starts, to be very, I'd say 90% of the focus is on notifications and turning your wrist into a notification hub. And instead of icons, it's basically almost entirely gesture-based. So it's all about swiping and scrolling up and down and dismissing and doing actions from side to side. There's a little bit of tapping when you want to go deeper on any particular thing, like the weather, you'll tap it and get a little more information. But basically, the whole idea is to bring you the right notifications at the right time. Context is a big deal here. And I think a lot of the groundwork that Google did with Glass, even though it's not Android Wear specifically, what they did with this device that I'm wearing in terms of context has really informed what they're doing with Android Wear. It's like, okay, what do people want to see on a wearable device? Because you don't want to flood them with all the notifications that they get on, say, a smartphone. So I've only just started using them. Obviously, they just became available today. So far, it's, you know, it's okay. It's recording some steps. You know, that's the other 10%. You know, the more sensors and stuff you put on these things, the more you can do. And though these two watches seem extremely similar, the Samsung one differs a little bit in that it also has a heart rate monitor. They're really big into heart rate monitor Samsung these days. So those are the main things we found out. We also found out the Moto 360, the first round Android Wear device, will not be available until this summer. But it is here at the show, although they're only sort of showing it in the demo retail mode. At least it's here, and it is gorgeous.
They also said they were going to give everybody at the show one of those when it comes out. They're going to send it to them. So that was another big Benny for attendees at the show. Now, Seth Weintraub, they made a big emphasis on the idea that Android Wear devices need to be glanceable and contextual. What did they mean by that? What are they talking about there?
Can you hear us, Seth?
I see your face on there, but I'm not getting any audio.
Okay. So
Android Wear is glanceable and contextual.
Yeah, that was my question.
It's basically an extension of Google Now. I'm looking at mine right now, and it's kind of like a notification tray in your Android phone. And you know, you scroll down, you use the down thing, and you can go through all of your different notifications that you would normally see in your notifications on a smartphone. So it's helpful to think of it that way. It basically is an extension of your phone, and it's helpful to think of it that way rather than, it does have sensors like the heart rate monitor and the steps. But other than that, the screen is basically Google Now with some extras.
Now, Don, one of the issues here is information overload with these devices. Google is making a big deal out of making sure that the user interface, they're talking to developers at the show, of course, and they're telling developers, look, you don't want to pack it with all this stuff. You don't want a bunch of icons. You just want this very quick demo. In fact, one of the sessions on Google on Android where they simulated what the interfaces look like when somebody's running. They were all shaking around and like very kind of blurry. And they said, this is how some people are going to use this while they're jogging. And so you need to be super, super clear on what you notify people of. But then a developer got up and said, well, what if somebody's wearing both Glass and an Android Wear device? Will their phone and both wearable devices all ring at the same time? And Google said, yes, they will.
Great.
Are you worried about this?
Well, as someone who does not is not sporting Google Glass, these are regular prescription lenses. I think Google's experimenting with various ways to incorporate their technology into wearable devices. You know, and I'm not sure that most people are going to be wearing computers both over their eyes and on their wrist. Maybe that's the Google vision, but I don't see that as a mainstream proposition, at least not yet.
Yeah, well, I'm worried because on Google Voice, this is a problem already. Your computer rings and your phone rings, but the computer rings about 3 or 4 seconds before the phone, and then when you answer the phone, it continues to ring on the laptop. They haven't figured it out in the other case where they're doing this. Hopefully, they'll have a better solution for wearable devices. Even one wearable device, if two devices are ringing at the same time, it could be too much. So let's talk about some of these other things that they announced. So Pete, tell us about Android Auto. What did we learn about Android Auto yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, we basically learned, you know, that this is what it's going to be called. Before now, it was just called Android in the car. With Android Auto, we got a few more details. We got to know that exactly what the focus is going to be, that there's going to be messages, audio, and navigation are the three main things, which is pretty much exactly what you want in the car. That we kind of saw that coming. And what I found interesting was that their messages and audio are going to be open first, with navigation coming later. This to me seems to be a little bit of a protection thing for Google Maps. I don't know why you'd want to use anything else in the car, but I sort of tweeted out at the time, like, sorry Nokia, you won't be able to put your Maps app in Android Auto right off the bat. So I feel like this is a play by them, so that if other third parties need to integrate some mapping solution in their in-car apps, they're going to have to use Google Maps at start. And that's going to sort of make sure that sort of becomes a standard, so that when they do open the navigation later to other companies like Nokia, it'll already be sort of built in, that there's this integration. I don't think that's a necessary thing. Maybe, you know, I mean, what else are you going to use? I mean, you could use Nokia, some people do, but anyway, we found out some a little more detail there. And I haven't had a chance to do a hands-on with it yet. I've been all over the Android Wear stuff. But they do have some cars here, and I'm looking forward to that.
I just assumed that those cars were just people with super good parking spaces. But I guess I was mistaken. No, I actually stood in line to get in the car yesterday, and the line moved so slow I never made it to a car before they shut down the whole conference center. So unfortunately, maybe we can check that out today. Now, I always thought that the car stuff that Google's doing is similar to Android itself. I think Google saw its life flash before its eyes in fear that they would be locked out of the mobile world, that their apps would be locked out and they wouldn't have any control. And that's possibly why they acquired and then developed Android into the juggernaut that it is today. And, of course, in the car, people are going to be embracing other solutions, which, of course, especially in Apple's case, Apple could be a player in the automobile dashboard world, and they could be shut out of automobiles if Apple predominates, and so they want to make the world safe for Google Maps and other services. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, Seth Weintraub, let's talk about the L version of Android. First of all, why haven't they named it yet? Isn't it obvious that this should be Lifesaver? I mean, what's going on there? Why haven't they named it?
I heard it was going to be Lemonheads.
Yeah.
But I didn't name it. It's very strange. I don't know. They have a mascots out in front of the Android building, and I don't know what they're going to do now. They're just going to have a big L, I guess, like one of these.
Yeah, exactly. Right. We're going to call it the L word, but it's already a show. All that. So what did you think about the L version? What did you think about some of the news that they announced, especially around the user interface convention that they talked about?
I think it's pretty interesting. The design is very kind of complete now. I think Max Duarte came in and kind of polished things up for the last two or three versions of Android. And now he's kind of had time to just kind of fully own it, kind of in the same way that he did with Palm and actually HipChat before that. So it looks complete, it looks full. Everything's cleaner, the email looks a lot smoother, easier to read, and it extends across all the different devices. So it seems cohesive now.
Now, Don, they also announced Android TV, of course, and one of the things that people were talking about were the games and the performance of games. They were showing a little game console box that was there, and I talked to the people there, and they said, no, it's not going to be a box. It could be a box if the company that makes the TV wants a box, but it's really up to them. It's technology to be built into the television. They also had a little game controller, looked kind of like an Xbox controller, and they said they built it, but just to demonstrate they're not going to be building any hardware in this space. What was your perception of Android TV, and to what extent do you think Google's going to be able to compete in the console gaming world with this product?
Well, I mean, this is another attempt to get Google TV right. You'll remember back in 2010, Google made this very highly publicized move into the living room as part of its plan to propagate its very powerful Android software on every single screen in our lives, you know, from the screen in our car dash to the screen in our living room to the screens that we have with us on our personal devices. What's different this time around is Google has actually taken a lot of the complexity out of Android TV. It feels more like a natural television device. The navigation is driven by large images that would look familiar to someone who has used Netflix or Hulu. You navigate moving left, right, up, or down. It's a very simple sort of five-button navigation, and it feels like it's a much more fluid television-like experience. It doesn't feel like a Rubik's Cube, you know, which is... go ahead.
And Don, what of Google TV? Has that sort of quietly just disappeared or unwound, or am I just not aware that it's...
That. No, it's gone. Okay. Google TV died a quiet death, and then Google went back to its labs and came up with Chromecast, which has been very popular. That's the $35 dongle that you plug into your television and then use your mobile devices to transfer web video to the TV. So that was kind of a proof of concept that you could design something inexpensively that would bring streaming video to the TV without using the Google TV approach, which was a browser and a full-on keyboard. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I'm not wanting to type to access TV shows on my, on the big screen in my living room. It's just not a natural behavior. So that's gone away with Android TV. Android TV is designed to be incorporated in television sets. It can sit in set-top boxes. It depends on what the manufacturers want to do with it.
And getting away from typing is actually kind of a big theme of a lot of the announcements, it sounds like, yesterday, being kind of going to voice control, being at the heart of contextual awareness. And so I am curious about this paradox, though, that Mike talked to a little earlier. Just seeing Pete with all his devices seemed really overwhelming to me. My digital life was supposed to simplify things for me. And yet, do y'all believe that, and this is for anyone, that Google's work in this space is actually going to simplify and make our lives clear some of the digital detritus in our life? Or is it going to add to it?
I think we're going to be, drowning under a cascade of information, just like we are today.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, let's think about our lives. There was a time not too long ago when we didn't have a mobile phone, a smartphone with us. We didn't have a tablet or a laptop with us sort of constantly as we do now. I'm being inundated with messages on social media, be it Facebook or Twitter or, any other platform. I think what may happen is that we will feel initially overwhelmed, as we always tend to do when we have new ways to access information. And then we as humans learn to manage that and how much input we want in our lives. I mean, if we want to be, we want to be immersed in it and perhaps not the real world, then that's a choice we can make. I'm sure Google will enable that.
He is a journalist, and he has to be impartial between the two watches, so he's got to wear both of them. You got to wear one on the right hand and one on the left. You have to do that, otherwise.
I'm not seeing that one on right. I'm seeing some Fitbit hanging there with right next to his.
There you go.
Oh, check you out.
I don't think it's.
You're like Wonder Woman. You're like digital Wonder Man.
Right, you throw data at it, and it bounces off of his wrist. Yeah, so.
No, I agree with a lot of that, but we are overwhelmed with information. I see the in-context stuff and wearables as kind of an attempt to organize in some ways, because it's like, for example, you have a digital boarding pass, And, you know, currently, if you just have a smartphone, you have to dig out your phone, find that email or that thing, or fire open that app and, you know, do all this stuff when you, you know, arrive at the airport, which is, you know, admittedly first world problems. But, you know, it is kind of an inconvenience. And for a certain type of person, it's just not going to work. Then just give me the paper one. Whereas if you had it simply appear on a screen on your wrist right at the exact time, it's, you know, I see a convenience there. I see that's not drowning in information. That's actually finding the exact thing you need right then and bringing it to the most convenient place. And this is a very hard thing to do. And it's, Google is just kind of figuring it out, and other people are too. But I do see the promise in wearables. Having worn glass for a year and messed with a bunch of smartwatches and seeing where notifications are at the right time, when it happens, when it works, it really works.
Yeah,
and I think that is why wearables will be a fad. They're not. I don't think they're going to go away.
Yeah, I agree that they're not going to go away. I agree with you that the risk is less about information overload, but I think the real risk is the fact that we come to rely on Google to decide where our attention goes. That Google's algorithms will be deciding what we see, what we don't see, and that, I think, is the bigger risk. Well, there's so much more to cover, and we'll be going to be covering the stories on this from this event over the next week, I'm sure, at least. So there's a lot more to cover here, but we have to move along. So I want to thank Seth Weintraub, who's at 9to5google.com and 9to5mac.com, and also LL Seth J. I love that, on Twitter. Thank you so much, Seth.
Thank you all.
All right, and I want to thank Dawn Chmielewski at recode.net, and she's also on Twitter at DawnC331. Thanks, Dawn.
Thank you.
And the draped in technology, Pete Pachal, is at Mashable.com and on Twitter at Pete Pachal. Show us those watches one more time, Pete.
And we lost Pete.
We lost Pete. Well, thank you so much for coming on Tech News Today, Pete, wherever you now are. He made it through the entire thing using the wireless at a show where everybody at the show is using wireless. So that was quite an amazing feat. Well, in just a sec, we're going to talk about Aereo's last bad day in court, possibly. But first, I want to tell you about Gazelle. Gazelle is a company that will buy your used gadgets. They'll not only buy it, they're going to give you really, really good money for it. And to find out how much money they'll give you for your used gadgets, just go to gazelle.com. That's GAZELLE.com. Find your item. Tell them what condition it's in, whether it's in great condition, lousy condition, or so-so condition. They'll quote you a price. That price is locked in for 30 days. So if the value goes down of that device, they'll still honor that price. And what happens is they'll send you a box. You put the device in the box. You send it off to them using the self-addressed, pre-addressed, pre-paid-for shipping. Off it goes, and then they pay you very quickly by check, PayPal, or if you use the Amazon gift card option, you get an extra 5%. That's a great option, by the way. That's the one that I use when I use Gazelle. And, you know, they've paid more than $100 million to over 700,000 customers. And my favorite part of all this is that your device, instead of gathering dust, is being put back to use. It's being refurbished. They completely wipe all of your data. So even if you forget to do that, you should do that before you send it in. But if you forget, they'll take care of it for you and completely erase it all. So it's no hassles. It's fast. It's free to ship. And you get paid for gadgets you're not using. And that can fund your next gadget, which you will someday also not use and sell to Gazelle. So find out what your Apple and Android device is worth. Take a minute. Go to gazelle.com and find out. And do it now, because your device may lose value the longer you wait. So, Elise, tell us about Aereo. I know you've been covering this story for quite a while. What happened yesterday?
As you all were paying attention to Google I/O and checking out cool new gadgets and devices and cars, those of us on the East Coast were watching very closely the Supreme Court here in Washington, D.C., and what they were deciding on a few sort of key items, not only warrantless wiretapping of phones, but this startup TV streaming service, Aereo. It will now have to figure out a reworked business plan or unwind completely after the Supreme Court ruled that it was in violation of copyright laws. This two-year-old company was using these tiny antennas to let subscribers in 11 cities watch and record live broadcast TV. Now the Supreme Court says its business plan is essentially illegal. And one of its big backers, Barry Diller, had said that if they lost in court, they didn't have a plan B. So we are talking with another Washingtonian, Brian Fung of the Washington Post today, about sort of what's next and what's next for consumers.
Brian is not with us. We were unable to raise him so far. We're still trying. In the meantime, you and I can talk about it. Of course, you've covered it heavily, and we talked about it in the show before. But this is quite a turn of events, and some people are saying that this is the end of innovation for cloud computing, which I think is at best a wild exaggeration. And it's also a problem for the future of television. So what do you think about that?
So it definitely slows down some of the competition in the television space. The big cable companies had already started, largely in response to Aereo and its innovations, had started allowing us to kind of get TV everywhere, be able to watch the World Cup. Well, not you, Mike, watching the World Cup. But
yeah, that's not going
to
happen.
The World Cup as an example, of course, being able to watch the World Cup from airports off of our mobile devices and whatnot, if we were, say, a Time Warner or a Comcast subscriber. Aereo was letting folks do that for $12 a month or as low as $8 a month. And so the competition was already sort of spurring innovation. Now, the Supreme Court did not say that its cloud storage was running afoul of copyright law. So it'll be really interesting to see sort of how they might be able to retool or sort of maybe possibly share its cloud service or sell it to small cable providers, the non-Comcasts of the world, who haven't developed their own TV everywhere and ways of recording and storing programs that users want to watch. So Aereo, I checked with them again just before we started this netcast, Mike, and they said they're still trying to figure out what's next and that they're going to contact their subscribers to let them know directly what's going to happen with all their stuff.
Yeah, there are a couple of weird things about this. First of all, some commenters are saying that they just need to go and negotiate contracts with the content providers just like everybody else does. And I think that that would be an interesting meeting. I'd love to be in that meeting because then, you know, it's like payback time. You know, they were trying to rebroadcast content without permission or without paying for it. And so I think that the studios and the content creators were really, you know, obviously honked about this. And they would probably not be a very nice bunch of people to negotiate with about the future of licensing that content. The other part
of it is... Yeah, can you imagine those conversations?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other part of it is for them to become a cloud storage company, they really... The secret sauce are those little antennas, the whole concept of getting in-the-air broadcast through an antenna, that was really the guts of their business. That's where most of their patented intellectual property was. And it was an interesting concept. My problem with this ruling is that the Supreme Court wasn't specific enough, in my opinion, about exactly what it is they're banning or why they're banning it. It was slightly vague. They did, to their credit, they did specifically narrow it to this particular company and this particular case. So this doesn't mean that, you know, rebroadcasting or other technologies are covered by this ruling. But the problem is, where is the line exactly that they're drawing? So I can obviously buy an antenna at Radio Shack, put it on my roof, and get terrestrial TV through that antenna. Okay, so I can run the cord down the street and put it there. That's legal. I can hire a company to install one on the roof that they own the antenna, and I can rent it from them or lease it from them. That's legal. If they have their antenna down the street, that's legal. How is it a distance from your house? They didn't establish what the exact line in the sand is. Theoretically, Aereo claims that they were simply renting antennas to folks and also providing cloud services and TiVo-like, you know, storage. But I would like to see I would have liked to have seen this. They're done talking about this, obviously, but I would like to have seen them exactly specify what it is that Aereo did that they believe should not be allowed.
So the points you're making sort of echo what Justice Scalia said, actually, in his dissent, that this was vague and it opens up a lot more questions than it answers. But for me, one observation is that it speaks to this larger question I have about the high court, which is, technology always seems to develop faster than regulation can keep up with it. And so do our policymakers and then do our judges understand the technology well enough to be able to make these big decisions on whether they're going to survive or not? And I'd be really interested to see sort of historical parallels when there was new technology, whatever it was, whether it was telephones or trains, and whether justices were able to rule effectively on something that was kind of a new concept for a lot of them personally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's no way they're ever going to really understand brand new technology well enough to rule on it from a technology savvy point of view. My problem with how they tend to look at these things is they always look at precedents. So they tend to look at any sort of new technology as, oh, this is just like the telegraph system.
VHS, right, or whatever it is.
You know, and so, and the problem is that it isn't. So much new technology isn't anything like old technology. And they try to grapple with these issues philosophically and legally and constitutionally, but ultimately they're always going to be at a disadvantage. And this is just sort of built into the system. And I would just hope that, you know, the lawyers come to specialize, the lawyers who represent technology companies come to specialize in how they can articulate the technological elements of these cases to Supreme Court justices in terms they can understand, and also that we kind of evolve away a little bit from the legal system's obsession with precedent. Yes, we have to set legal precedents, but we can't, just because something is analogous to an old technology that people understand doesn't mean that the same rules should apply to that new technology. We need new rules for our new technology. And so there's so much for them to rule on these days, and there's so many difficult issues that we really have to make some progress there in how they deal with these things. Anyway, your stories on this have been really awesome, Elise Hugh, and I've enjoyed reading them. You can, again, see those as well at npr.org. Just search for Elise's name and you'll find those. Now, although in another story, although Google didn't even mention the H word in its keynote yesterday, I'm talking about home automation, 9 to 5 Mac's Mark Gurman reports that Apple is working on mainstream smart home hardware. Apple is in the, quote, exploratory phase, unquote, according to the report, which is based on unnamed sources. Apple is less interested in peripheral devices like those sold by Google's Nest Labs, for example, smart thermostats, smart smoke detectors, that sort of thing. And instead, they're pursuing more central and mainstream hardware products like home speaker systems or control panels. Elise Hugh, I think it was just a matter of time before Apple got into the home automation hardware business. Although the way that company moves these days, if they're in the exploratory phase now, we're not going to see anything for 3 or 4 years at the earliest.
And to be honest with you, I was really surprised to read this news, Mike, because at WWDC, it seemed like their focus was going to be on, they were definitely getting in the home automation game, but really as being the central hub, becoming the platform by which you could control your smart thermostat, your smart fridge, your smart appliances of all kinds, and not actually wanting to say, hey, we're going to be making speakers as well. And so it was interesting to me. It surprised me a little bit more than you, I guess, it sounds like, Mike.
Yeah, and of course, they've also acquired Beats. And so now the Beats founders, Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre, he is a doctor, you know, are now part of the, you know, decision-making process at Apple. And I think this, you know, these smart speakers sound like just the kind of thing that somebody like Jimmy Iovine might be really interested in Apple pursuing. So there could be a sort of slight changing the guard. Steve Jobs has been gone for a few years now, and now they brought in some people who are obsessed with music hardware. So we'll see if that redirects their direction there. But one way or the other, all of these companies, especially Google and Apple, even though Google didn't talk about it much yesterday during the keynote, all of these companies are going to be huge in home automation. Home automation is coming to a living room near you and to a home near you. So there's just no question at all that one way or the other, they're going to be battling each other on this new battlefield. So we'll keep an eye out for that. Well, that's the tech news today. Elise Hugh, thank you so much. Where can people find your work? I've already mentioned npr.org. That's the main place, right?
That's right. And, of course, on your local member station on NPR. And it sounds like there's some excitement in my office because The U.S. did not score, came close to scoring. but you can hear me on our tentpole shows morning edition, which airs in the morning, east or coast to coast, and in the afternoons, all things considered.
Yeah, I haven't decided whether there we go, nice soccer ball. I haven't decided whether I'm going to go watch the World Cup game or if I'm going to go outside and watch some grass grow. I can't decide which is more exciting. I'm on the fence. Well, Alicia, thanks again. Appreciate everything, and we'll see you next Thursday.
All right, thanks, Mike. All right, thanks to the team.
All right, you can subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT or on YouTube at youtube.com/TechNewsToday, and please follow us on Twitter, Tech News Today TV. You can also join our Google Plus community and also circle our page. Just search for Google Plus. Search Google Plus for Tech News Today, and we want to hear from you. Send me, tell me how wrong I am about soccer at tnt@twit.tv, or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific, tonight and every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.